People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trojan welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. And just recently, we had the pleasure of Ben Schumann, the pianist, being in town to play Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 1 with the Cape Town Philharmonic Orchestra. And while he was here, I managed to get hold of Ben to catch up with him where he's at the moment, his home in London and what he's been up to. You may know that Ben is the winner of the 11th UNISA Vodacom International Piano Competition way back in 2008. He went on to win several more competitions, including the Standard Bank Young Artist Award for Music in 2011 and the Contemporary Music Prize at the Cleveland International Piano Competition in 2013. And then, in 2016, he was awarded the Huberto Rupert Prize from the South African Academy of Arts and Sciences for his contribution to music in his native country. He's also a Steinway's artist and has given acclaimed solo, chamber, and concerto performances internationally as well as all over South Africa. So it's good to have you back in Cape Town, albeit briefly, Ben. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Rodney.
How often do you get to come to South Africa? Fairly regularly now, because your home is London, isn't it?
My home is London, but in 2018, I started a new position at the University of Pretoria, where I am a senior lecturer in piano and musicology. So I travel quite frequently from London to South Africa to teach. I have about 10 or 11 masters and doctoral students,
okay,
and I work with them on their piano playing as well as their research and their dissertations.
Is that practical? Does that work? I mean, having students in London and also in Pretoria?
So far, it has proven to work quite well,
okay,
partly because of the wonderful technology that is readily available. I have Skype and WhatsApp, and it's such a wonderful way to speak to students all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They can send me written work when I'm in London, when I'm giving concerts there. And I can also sometimes even give a piano lesson on Skype. I'll hear very well, and I can easily say what I think should improve or change. But when I am in Pretoria, I then spend more time actually at the keyboard with the students.
Okay. I think I might have made a mistake just now when I said that you're also lecturing in London. Or are you lecturing in London?
No,
I thought your lectureship is at Pretoria.
That's right.
So in London, your main focus?
My main focus is concertizing. I engage in quite a variety of activities, not only solo work, but also sometimes concertos, and sometimes I work with predominantly two or three duo partners that I give concerts with. So one is, of course, Tessa Eis,
mm-hmm,
and the other one is Ansel Gerber, who lives in Vienna, and my brother-in-law, David Finter, also lives in London.
He's the flautist, isn't
That's
he,
right,
David
yes.
Finter? Oh, he's your brother-in-law.
Yes.
I see. So it sounds, Ben, as though you really do enjoy chamber music as well as the sort of solo playing and orchestral playing.
Very much so. I think chamber music is a phenomenal way to communicate and to share these wonderful phrases. Say, for example, Brahms is such a significant composer, both of solo work as well as chamber music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the one really feeds the other. You can't play the solo works without constantly engaging with the chamber music. And this really inspires me. Of course, I love the two cello sonatas, and I love the quintet, and I love the quartets, but also the piano trio. Piano trio is all three of them.
And then there are the two piano concertos, but the one of which you played recently for us here in Cape Town, the mighty D minor, number one. And I mean, I think I'm right in saying mighty, isn't it? Somebody said, and I think it might have been Clara Schumann, that it was a symphony with piano obbligato, because it's a massive work, isn't it, for everyone involved?
Both concertos by Brahms are really symphonic. I think Emil Gilels, for example, in his recording with you, Eugen Jochum at the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, really understood this immensity of the music, the piano almost equaling the orchestra,
mm-hmm,
in terms of its scope and breadth. And I think That's why it's so difficult to perform, because it takes so much. Every fiber of one's being has to take part in the whole proceeding, I think.
Yes.
And you have to really match the orchestra in terms of sound, color, emotion.
Yes. It's not like a glittering solo, like a Liszt concerto, for example, where Liszt is written in such a way that the piano really does sort of glitter, is the word I want to use. You really, textually, very involved with the orchestra, with this Brahms, aren't you?
Or even the Paganini Rhapsody by Rachmaninoff, or... Then you get, of course, the more integral concertos like Chopin or even Rachmaninoff's Second, where the piano is very much part of the longer line.
Mm-hmm.
But in Brahms, it's difficult because I think the two entities, the orchestra and the soloist, really alternate with each other. So there are many passages in the Brahms concertos where you play alone as soloist, and then
yes.
you have to really keep the flow and keep the phrasing. And
but I remember I was talking to the English pianist John Lill, who had just played a Brahms one here some years ago, and what struck me about his performance was the sound he got out of the piano without making it sound as though he was hammering the piano. And I think this must be a big challenge, isn't it? Because it's big clutch fistfuls of notes, isn't it? And the sound must be so important.
The sound is the real expression, because the importance is to keep the phrasing and to keep the flow, but at the same time to have that intimacy and sincerity in one's playing, to really express what you feel without losing the architecture and the structure. And that is what is so important, but so few pianists actually succeed. And definitely one of the artists that I feel did succeed in this was Radu Lupu, the Romanian pianist, whom I've always admired. And I will never forget, in 2013, I went to the Enescu Festival in Bucharest, where I played the Liszt E-flat concerto. You've mentioned that piece. But I then went to listen to Radu Lupu playing Beethoven 4th with Barenboim and the orchestra. And then two nights later, he gave a recital, which I must say was probably the best piano recital I ever heard in my life.
My goodness.
The last two sonatas of Franz Schubert, and it was simply unbelievable. I was so moved and overtaken by
He has an incredible aura of respect around him, doesn't he? And he's a bit of a mysterious figure as well, isn't he, Radu Lupu?
I remember him coming on stage, and it felt as if he was completely in a trance. I really felt that he wasn't there. He was in his own space, and he sat down at the piano if it had been his living room and his own environment, and he just played these works of Schubert. It was talking directly to God or to the composer. Or
gosh,
it was just a fantastic experience.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a seat in Bucharest. The concerts are all sold out, but people, students and young musicians, never pay. They always just enter the hall. They scurry into the hall and they sit at the railings on the stairs and everywhere. That hall was so packed because it was the first time in decades that he'd actually come back to Bucharest, and it was an absolute momentous occasion.
I can hear and see what effect that must have had on you. And now your first piece of music, in fact, is an excerpt from this Brahms Piano Concerto in a Moment with Radu Lupu.
That's
is that
correct.
What you've chosen? And presumably you like this recording very much.
I do. I feel that he's done exactly what you said one shouldn't do. One shouldn't barnstorm in that piece. One should play it with chamber music like simplicity and intimacy. And that's what he does. He's so intelligent, and he lets the music speak quietly. Yet there is this strength, this inner strength that he portrays. So this recording is with the London Philharmonic Orchestra and the wonderful conductor Edu de Waard. And I really love the tempo choices and everything about it.
Okay, but we're going to listen to just part of the last movement, aren't we?
Yes.
Because the first movement is so huge. So part of the last movement. Here we go. Well, there's part of the opening of the third movement of the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Brahms. That recording with Radu Lupu, the pianist, the London Philharmonic, and Edo De Waart conducting. And a favorite recording of Ben Schumann, my guest on People of Note this week, who, as we've been saying, recently performed the concerto here in Cape Town with the Cape Town Philharmonic, conducted by Bernard Gurler. And Ben, you were speaking about the structure and all that, and that concerto is so long, it must be also a bit of a physical marathon. It's a long concerto, the same as the second one. It's not a sort of half-hour affair.
Yes, I spoke to my professor in London, Ronan O'Hora, whom I greatly admire, as also as a Brahms interpreter, and I remember when I played the second concerto years ago, also with the Cape Philharmonic Orchestra, it was a big sensation for me to immerse myself into this great work, also partly because there are such diabolical technical things in the piece that one feels one has to overcome. But he actually put me at ease and said that the second piano concerto is a harder learn, but the first piano concerto is a harder play.
That is interesting, isn't it?
And I tend to agree with him on that. Partly also because the first concerto was written so much earlier in Brahms's life, and he was extremely in pain. He was suffering, I think, from this terrible suicide attempt of Schumann, whom he so admired. Yeah. And he looked after Clara and her family, and he was very involved in the proceedings there. And that, I think, made a big impact on the work. It was written exactly at the same time.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's so much more emotional turmoil, and one can easily lose oneself in that. As a performer, someone should try to always work hard at keeping this architecture.
And isn't it interesting that he wrote it? He spent a while, I think, if I remember, nice, I'm getting mixed up, trying to decide what to do with it. He wrote the first movement, and he was going to call it something else, even, I think, considered calling it a fantasy for piano and orchestra. He couldn't quite work out what to do with it.
Or a symphony. The first symphony, in fact, and the writing is very symphonic, as we said, but it's also pianistically very different from the second concerto.
Second concerto
is very classical in some ways. I think if you think about the last movement, it's very almost transparent, like a Mozart work. And I think that makes a big difference. In this concerto, you have to negotiate certain technical aspects and colors that are quite revolutionary, I think, for the time.
Yeah.
Written in the same period as well as the Liszt Sonata in B minor.
Oh.
Two such radically different compositions.
Yes.
But it shows one what an exciting time that must have been.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And also, the style of piano was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, wasn't it? So Brahms was able, as Liszt was, to explore this magnificent, relatively new instrument that people like Beethoven and Mendelssohn and even Chopin hadn't really come across.
Exactly, and it is an orchestral instrument, that can, you know, carry big things and big sounds.
Is it the sort of piano writing, you know, they say Rachmaninoff's concertos lie under the fingers. Did Brahms do that, or is it difficult writing from Brahms's point? Does it lie easily under the fingers, to put it naively?
Brahms never lies easily. For me.
I thought you might say that.
The thing is, look at my hands, they are not big. But I play from my heart, so my hands do not really stop me, but I I don't allow them to stop me.
Okay.
But sadly, I have a preponderance for this type of repertoire of Brahms and Rachmaninoff and Liszt. I love to play it because it transcends me, so I love to do it. And I have to always negotiate and work at strategies to play these things. Rachmaninoff's third concerto is unbelievably spread out in its writing. But same for the Brahms D minor, I think. There is one passage in the last movement where one has to play with one's first and second fingers to a third, and then a whole octave between the second and the fifth. And it's a long, big, extended run cascade of sound that goes down. So it has to be very strong. And it's very difficult to play.
And you are a Steinway artist, and you know now that you've visited us that we have a magnificent, relatively new Steinway here that François de Toey chose for us, and which everyone is sort of raving about. Was it okay, the piano?
Yes, it's of course an instrument with beautiful lyrical qualities, and I think that helped me to play this work. And I think the acoustics of this hall are just amazing. I love playing, and it's very warm and embracing.
And also you have a very warm audience here, because you're very much admired, I think, here in Cape Town, as in South Africa. So I know there was a great deal of interest so that you were coming back to perform. So it must make, all these things must make you feel quite at home up there on the stage.
Yes, I have spent so many wonderful times on that stage in the City Hall. It is a magical place, and I think it's got so much history to it. If one thinks about all the artists that did play there, I think Arthur Rubinstein played in the Alhambra Theatre, I believe.
I think it was the Alhambra, yes.
Yeah, 1939. But yeah, many artists of that stature came to Cape Town over the last century.
And so sat on that very stage, although it has been changed somewhat, as you've seen now, because they've refurbished the City Hall. And it's looking quite nice. Ben Schumann, my guest, what's your second choice of music and why?
We've already touched upon Rachmaninoff, a composer who wrote a lot for the piano. His four concertos and Paganini Rhapsody are works that I often practice and perform. But I feel even more drawn to his choral music.
Ooh,
not only the liturgy of St. John Chrysostomus, but also the Vespers, the all-night vigil. I have heard it at the proms and also in various churches in London, and I always try to attend such events because this work is something of a, it's a remarkable spiritual experience for me.
It's mesmerizing, almost hypnotic, isn't it? It transforms you, for want of a better word.
Yes, I feel that every time. Just as much as the Brahms First Concerto, I feel a very big emotional journey, but in the Vespers even more so, because it's so hypnotic, it's so long and extended. But I think this little track, the part Bogoritse Djevo, it's particularly close to my heart. It's also now close to Easter time, so I think it is an appropriate track to play today, and also particularly in this beautiful rendition by the Estonian Philharmonic Chorus Choir, conducted by Paul Hillier. And I would very much like to
so hear that excerpt then from the Rachmaninoff Vespers.
Oh.
I think you picked up the hypnotic atmosphere that that music creates. As Ben Schumann said before, that was one of the best. It was a work, a movement from the Rachmaninoff Vespers. And what was that, Ben?
It was Bogoritse Devo from the Vespers, Opus 37.
Yes. With the Estonian choir, the Estonian Philharmonic Choir.
That's right.
Well, I think that's a first on People of Note, the Rachmaninoff Vespers. So congratulations for choosing such a remarkable work. I've only ever heard it live once here in Cape Town. And gosh, it was, as you say, mesmerizing. Ben Schumann has been in Cape Town. He performed Brahms's first piano concerto during the 13th International Summer Festival with the Cape Town Philharmonic. And I managed to get hold of him before he fled off again, because it does sound as though you do a fair amount of traveling. You said earlier that you have to go between Johannesburg, or Pretoria, I should say, and London because of your lecturing job. Do you enjoy traveling, or is it a nightmare?
Yes, it's a nightmare, yes.
I'm so glad you said that.
I can't say that I like flying, but I just live with it. And the thing is, one can read a lot, which is wonderful. I love to read novels and books about music, and I tend to get through a lot of material, and as I am very interested in academic work and musicology.
Yes, that's right. Because, I mean, your PhD, your doctorate in music from the City of London, the University of London, was about the piano works of Stefan Schroffier, and also a study of stylistic influences, technical elements, and canon formation in South African art music. I mean, that's a very academic title. So clearly, apart from your performing side, you have a love of academia.
Yes, I do. Well, one of the most exciting things in my life was to meet Stefan Schroffier. Schroffier was one of the great composers, I could even say, of the 20th century in South Africa. He died in 2014 after 70 years of writing. So mm-hmm. You can imagine how much music there was to discover and to uncover and
To uncover,
analyze and yes. play. I only focused on his pianistic oeuvre. But nobody had ever really sat down with him as much, you know, talking in detail, in depth, about how one actually has to play this work and how this music, and how he came to adopt a certain style, writing for the piano in the way he did, how it developed over the years. And I think this was quite revelatory to talk to him in Pretoria at his home about the works from the 1940s, the 1950s, 1970s, and so forth, and how he got into the African music, the music from Africa period. Started around in 1984 when he heard a worker sing in the street a certain song, and he incorporated that into his sonata on African motifs for violin. Mm-hmm. And then he adopted a new sort of cataloging system, music from Africa number one, etc., until he reached about number 45. At the time of his death. So he was very prolific in his last stylistic period. And I wrote a lot about this, also about aesthetics of late style in a composer's work and how that differs from his earlier utterances and styles and colors. So it was fascinating to work with him. And it's a very important thing for young musicians to make use of the opportunity.
Of course.
To speak to a composer while they are still alive.
Yes.
And he wrote these last three works. He wrote for me, which was a big privilege and honor.
Does that include this? He wrote a concerto for piano, cello, and orchestra for you and Ansel Herber.
That's right. He wrote it. It's called Bushman Prayers. And we played it here in Cape Town in 2015 and in Natal and KwaZulu-Natal with the orchestra. It was a very exciting work. And we plan to perform it in Europe quite a few times during the next couple of seasons. Very large orchestration, but very transparent, so we can do it with smaller ensembles, which is logistically also good. He wrote a piano quintet as well for me, and the Odeon String Quartet, and we premiered it. And then, of course, the solo cycle, the Seasons, My Seasons, in 2012, which I also premiered at his 90th birthday symposium.
My goodness me.
So it was great to play all this music in his company.
What was it about him? I mean, how did you discover him? Did you discover him through his music first? Or had you met him? Or were you impressed by his personality as well as his music? Or was he a difficult man? Or What was it about? It seems though he's had a huge influence on you.
Well, these are all very important remarks. Gruvje loomed large in Pretoria. He was in my study years, you know, when I was growing up. One always saw this enigmatic figure with his white jacket and his bow tie at the international music competitions.
That's right.
His works were often prescribed for the first round. And I remember the Songs and Dances from Africa being played in 1992. We were host family to a young Russian pianist from St. Petersburg. And he was practicing the Gruvje music. And it fascinated me right from that. I was very young at the time. And it fascinated me immensely. So then I went to study at Pretoria University at Tux, and I actually met him through my professor. Professor Stanford introduced me to him, and I had a master class with him on some of his works. And so we started a friendship actually from that period onward, and then he was delighted when I actually moved to London and I said I'm going to do a doctorate on his music.
Okay. And had you completed the doctorate before he died?
Sadly not. I would so much have liked to.
Because he would have, wouldn't it have been lovely for him to have read it and been with you, to be part of it being published?
Absolutely, and there were so many questions that I still wanted to ask him as I finalized this very long and arduous task, this manuscript. So it was a very rewarding task, but a little bit sad as well. I also had to cancel the premiere, the initial premiere of the double concerto, so he wasn't alive when we then finally did it.
Okay, now I can imagine that would have been sad for you. All right, I think it's time for another piece of music now. I see Bartok lurking here on the desk.
Appropriately so, because it's very close to Stefan Gruvje. He was very much inspired by Bartok, especially in the 1940s when he wrote his famous Elegy for Strings in 1947, also partly based on this Raka by M.P. van Wyk Lo, the great Afrikaans writer, and the tremendous opposing forces in that epic comes across. But I think he took much inspiration, coloristically speaking, from Béla Bartók's work. And in fact, in 1939, Bartók wrote this incredible work for strings, the Divertimento, BB118. And when I was a youngster in Pretoria, I'm talking a lot about Pretoria. Actually, I had a wonderful musical upbringing in that city.
It sounds like it, yes.
Derek Oxer came with his string orchestra to Pretoria and asked me to play along as a violinist. I studied violin for 20 years. And I played in the orchestra, and we did this Divertimento for strings, and it really captured my imagination. The strong folklore, this wonderful, these melodies that Bartók incorporates, and the strong rhythmic impetus, and one will hear this in the last movement of the Bartók Divertimento, played in my choice of recording, played by the LSO String Ensemble, led by Roman Simovic, the concertmaster of the London Symphony Orchestra. And partly because I live in London, I studied at the Guildhall School, and I often went to all the concerts of the LSO, and I took part in their, you know, foundations, their schemes and things. So
perfect
fantastic
reason to play the London Symphony Orchestra strings here. We'll be right back. part of the Divertimento for Strings by Bartok with the London Symphony Orchestra Strings there, conducted by, Ben, who did you say?
That was conducted by Roman Simovic, led by him, actually. Okay.
My guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions, is the pianist Ben Schumann, who, as I said, has been in town playing Brahms for us here with the orchestra in Cape Town, Brahms's first piano concerto. You spoke about your young days in Pretoria and what an impact Pretoria had on you and the people that you were able to meet and work with. My usual question is to find out where this passion came from. Did you start music at a young age? When did the music love come?
My parents are both great music lovers, and I started with violin lessons when I was 4. My mother wanted to have my sister and myself play the violin when we were very young. So we started, and then she took us to many concerts. I always remember going to the ballet and to the, you know, the Arts Council performances at the State Theatre. It was a fantastic thing to see. I loved ballet also from a young age, and I often go to see ballet in London. I just actually saw the most beautiful Manon, this Massenet ballet compiled by Kenneth MacMillan, whom I much admire, his choreography. And of course I love all the Tchaikovsky ballets. I always go to see Swan Lake and
Glorious music, apart from anything else.
It's just genius, yes. I love going, and Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet is one of my favorite pieces of music
that's
anyway.
It's a remarkable work, that.
Gosh. Yes, that's mesmerizing
as
well.
Yes, there you go.
Or actually quite terrifying.
Oh, it's terrifying.
It's terrifying.
It's very upsetting
music.
Gosh, it's impressive.
But yes, so all these wonderful influences I had, and then I later went on to study at the University of Pretoria, and my violin professor was Zanta Hofmeyer.
Oh, really?
And I learned a lot from Zanta about violin playing and about technique. But then I also had the wonderful chance to play chamber music with her, and that was my first encounter with the Brahms trios. I mean, we did the B major trio, Opus 8, for a festival once, and that was the beginning of an important relationship with chamber music. And I always then, you know.
But Ben, when then did you start the piano? Because you said you took up the violin.
Yes.
Did you take the piano up shortly after that, sort of simultaneously?
Almost. I started, I think, when I was 6, and my father was composing and doing things on the piano, so my father got very irritated. I remember him storming in and said to my mother, "Listen, we just have to let him start with lessons now, otherwise he's going to drive us crazy." So I just always loved my lessons, and I had wonderful teachers. So
And did the violin playing fall away slowly but surely, or do you still play?
No, I think the moment the violin playing fell away was only at university. I was quite serious about the violin as well, and I did some national competitions and things.
Oh,
and
okay.
And I think the moment I won the piano competition at UNICE, the national piano competition, I started getting so many engagements and performances, and I didn't really have time to keep up both. I had to practice too much piano.
Mm-hmm.
That, coupled to the fact that my piano professor at Pretoria University, Joseph Stanford, I mentioned him earlier, said that he's going to step on my violin if I bring it into his classroom, because it takes away my time at the piano. And I composed as well.
Oh, so did you?
And I was quite serious about that as well. So he said, "No, you know, my dear," he said, "you cannot play the piano and compose and play violin. You have to choose something and then stick to it." And then, of course, I went to Italy to study, and my teachers were so demanding and so ruthless, and I was practicing around the clock, so I didn't have time to pursue both the violin and the composition. But at least I had that background and that interest. That, of course, makes chamber music and concerto playing easier.
But now, were any of the pieces that you wrote published?
No.
Nothing.
I think it was too derivative. Of course, it's something one has to develop more when you're young.
Right. And it's never come back. You've not ever had the urge to compose.
Not really. I think my interest lies more both in the interpretation of music and performance of it, but also the analysis and the musicological sphere.
Yes, because your approach, just as we're picking up from here, and also your thesis and all that, is, as I said, academic. So you are very much a thinker, aren't you? And in that respect, I see why you liked Radu Lupu, because he was very much, He was a kind of intellectual pianist, wasn't he?
Well, like he played at the festivals hall. Sadly, I was in Devon. I couldn't attend. Mm-hmm. But a thinker, yes. Sorry, what did you want to say?
No, I was just saying that thinker, the fact that he is the sort of intellect of the piano, is obviously what appeals to you, because you're obviously that yourself as well. And that's probably why you like Brahms so much, because you need a little bit, well, you need a huge sort of intellectual stash to be able to play this concerto or the second concerto.
Yes, I am very fond of the Romantic period anyway, because mm-hmm. I think it combines both the emotional qualities and the fantasy with intellectual rigor.
Yes.
And the two great poles, I would say, Richard Wagner and Brahms, Johannes Brahms, are the two composers who are such wonderful exponents of this.
Mm-hmm.
I love them both equally.
I'm so glad you love Wagner, because
I'm always sad when people feel they have to belong to
one or the other school,
yes. And it's nonsense, because they are both integral parts of the Romantic.
It's interesting you should say that, because I was having a chat to Richard Koch the other day, and he said how he'd love to do a study or a series of why the split happened. You know, after Berlioz's list. Wagner, and then after Beethoven, the Schubert, Schumann, Brahms, it's sort of split, and they shouldn't be split, because as you've just said, they're great composers, and they did great things in their own right. Why
yes.
should you belong to one school or the other?
Well, and they brought great variety. And the thing is also, what is very interesting, I like the idea of developing variation. The fact that Brahms used small blocks, small building blocks always, and even more so in his later works, which we will come to now.
Yes.
But Wagner and Liszt and those composers enjoyed the longer line.
That's
it's
right.
Continuing yes. melody. You already find that in one of the late sonatas of Beethoven, this Opus 101, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
Barenboim also said it's one of the hardest to play, and I think it's true. This fugue is a monster. But in any case, the first movement, this incredible line of it, really reminded me a bit of
Wagner.
This Wagnerian
that sort of endless
line.
Melody almost, that and endless line.
Exactly, and guess what? I went to a lecture of András Schiff at the Wigmore Hall, and what did he say? It was the favorite sonata of Wagner.
Oh, there you go.
Opus 101.
Yes.
And that's so interesting, and it's so true.
Mm-hmm.
But in Brahms, you have another side, something very classical at the same time, but also as he's taking these small cells and breaks them down and makes large-scale compositions out of them. He really set the table, I think, as he said, the whole
yes.
atmosphere of the 20th century in so many ways. And Schoenberg, of course, took a lot from him
in
that
respect.
That's
very interesting for you to say that.
And I always enjoyed following that trajectory as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one hears this in the piano trios, as we're talking about the piano trios earlier, and in the second one, the C major, Opus 87, written not long after the second piano concerto, one has these small little fragments and utterances. And the movement I want to play particularly is the scherzo from that, because it starts with this, these small motifs, and it's utterly scintillating. Mm. I love that. And I think this performance by Leonidas Kavakos and Yo-Yo Ma and Emmanuel Ax brings across the energy and the visceral qualities of the music beautifully.
Thank you.
That's music by Brahms, part of his piano trio. Which one was that, Ben?
That was the second piano trio, the C major one.
Okay. And Ben Schumann is my guest here on People of Note on Fine Music Radio this week. And Ben, we've been talking about your concert with the Cape Town Philharmonic, where you did the Brahms one. But you are also going to be performing at La Motte quite soon, aren't you, in a sort of more intimate setting as a recitalist?
That is correct. Hanneli Rupert advised me to choose a program that is in line with the Easter time, because of course it's only a week before Easter. And
when is the concert?
It's on the 13th of April.
Where?
At La Motte.
At La Motte, of course.
And I will be playing a recital with works of Johann Sebastian Bach and Franz Liszt and Sergei Rachmaninoff, all with a slightly religious aspect involved. The Sheep May Safely Graze, the Petri transcription by Bach, of Bach's work, and of course the French Suite in E-flat, which is quite an autumnal Bach, I think, beautiful for the Lent. And then I will play two works, the two Legends by Liszt, the Legends, the St. Francis of Assisi talking to the birds, preaching to the birds, and St. Francis of Paola walking on the waves. So there's not a good connection with the spiritual and the religious. And then finally Rachmaninoff's quite monumental second sonata, but in the revised version, which to my mind is quite orthodox, Russian orthodox, especially in the second subject of the first movement, the bell-like motifs that interspersed. So it's definitely, I think there's a nice thread running through that concert.
Right, good. And it is, it's a nice idea as well, as you say, so close to Easter. And then it also gives us a chance to hear quite a wide repertoire, because you do have, you spoke about Bach, we didn't speak enough about Bach, but next time. And then through Liszt, Rachmaninoff, Beethoven, Brahms.
Mozart, let's talk about Mozart, because Mozart is one of my absolute favorite composers.
Okay, well, I'll allow you to end with Mozart. How about that?
That is a good idea. In fact, the key of C major, we've listened to the Brahms trio in C, but C major is, according to the Affektenlehre, is the theme, the key of heavenly peace. There is something so open about it and so beautiful. And I remember playing, I play both two C major concertos by Mozart, the number 25 and the number 21, the Elvira Madigan. And I played the number 25 at the UNISA competition.
Oh, right.
That was a big moment in my life. I loved that work.
That's a grand one as well. Trumpets and drums.
Exactly.
It's a very grand concerto.
It's a grand piece. Mm. And this is also a grand piece, the following one. And I wanted to end with this. It's so upbeat and so exciting. Diana Damrau, one of the great sopranos, the leading musicians of our times, I heard her in the La Traviata recently at the Met Opera, at the live streaming, of course. I was in Scotland listening to it. But it was fantastic. She really moved me with her Violetta, the La Traviata. Mm-hmm. Also conducted by Yannick Nézet-Séguin, the principal of the New York Opera. And she will sing Der Marter aller Arten from Die Entführung aus dem Serail, a wonderful opera by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
That we don't get to hear enough of, by the way, Benjamin. Thank you very much, Ben Schumann, as we listen to Mozart now. Thank you for your time. I know I've caught you at a busy time, and it's been great chatting to you. Thanks for sharing some of your thoughts with us.
Thank you very much, Rodney.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
This March, Peter Turin presents Peter Schaffer's internationally acclaimed hit play, Equus. Starring Graham Hopkins and Sven Reichrock, with direction by Fred Abramser and movement by Mark Goldberg. For those who loved it, for those who missed it, catch this multi-award-winning play from the 29th of March until the 20th of April. That's Equus. Only at Theatre on the Bay. Book now.